Hi, this is John Hockenberry, and speaking to someone who clearly loves to listen at the time of their choosing, you should give the WNYC app a try, you know? Not only can you listen to this program, but it'll also automatically search for the kinds of stories and subjects you like. It's really cool, and it's free. There are other apps and radio stations available, but thanks for listening. Here's today's program. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Listening to history.
To all who sleep here, we can say we caught the torch. We kept the faith. And Americans and Belgians will always stand together for freedom, for dignity, and for the triumph of the human spirit.
There is history in the air as President Obama travels in Europe this week. At one of the battlefield memorials from World War I, the president attempted to connect the efforts to stop war today with the horrors of war that began nearly a century ago.
Our nations are part of the international effort to destroy serious chemical weapons, the same kinds of weapons that were used to such devastating effect on these very fields.
It's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long way to go.
President Obama at Flanders Field, where the poppies grow between the crosses row on row, as the famous poem says, noting in tragic verse some of the 14 million soldiers who died in the Great War. Buried beneath the president's feet as he visits these killing fields from World War I is a history that lies just beyond the horizon of our audio record. Fuzzy black and white stills, scratchy voices from places like Ypres, Verdun. The world simply slid, one historian has called it sleepwalking, into that conflagration at the beginning of a new century, at a moment boiling with the distractions of radical change.
It is a sort of white water moment of history, where history accelerates phenomenally. It is a time when these great inventions begin to grip millions, when industrialization, commercialization, globalization begin to be the reality of people's everyday lives.
Sound familiar? Historian Philip Blom is not speaking about 2014, but the years leading up to 1914.
Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, you, waltzing Matilda with me.
Are the echoes from World War I haunting world leaders exactly a century later? As obscure territorial disputes seem to be drawing the world into a dramatic confrontation, East versus West. Joining us to discuss all this is Margaret Macmillan, author of The War That Ended Peace, The Road to 1914. She's professor of international history at Oxford University. Professor, welcome.
Hello.
So what we saw in World War I was a sense of complacency about the world order and the map of the world as it stood in 1914. And, you know, a short 5 years later, all of that had changed. Are we in a state of complacency about the map of the world and the world order right now and don't see the potential for radical change?
I think there's something in that, because I think we get used to peace and we like to think it's a normal state of affairs. And I think in Europe before 1914, they'd had an extraordinarily long period of peace, punctuated, of course, with short wars. And I think they got used to the sense that peace was normal, that they could get through the crises. And perhaps we have something of the same since the end of the Cold War. And goodness knows there have been conflicts, but they haven't spilled over yet into much larger ones.
As a historian, can you describe the dynamic between the kind of big picture that leaders like President Obama speak about, how to behave in the 21st century, lecturing Vladimir Putin, the notion of territorial sovereignty in Ukraine, that sort of thing, and the passion of these very localized disputes of Russian-speaking majorities in Crimea, just as in the Balkans there were Serbians and Bosnians who were angry at each other, and that escaped the gaze of world leaders in 1914.
I think we always have a tension, if you like, between the sort of larger forces pushing for stability and the sorts of forces that can disrupt that stability. And we, I think we recognize, perhaps more clearly than we might have done in the 1990s, just how much people can be moved by passion, whether it's national passion, nationalism, or whether it's religiously inspired fervor. I mean, we're not always rational human beings, and we sort of take very seriously the ways in which we identify ourselves. And so you do get, I think, at a lot of levels, you get people feeling very strongly attached to particular identities. And I sometimes wonder if it's almost a result of globalization or tied to globalization somehow, that the more the world gets integrated, and perhaps the more strongly people cling to these very strongly felt national identities or local identities.
The Great War, as it was then called, and World War I it became, of course, after World War II, is such a historical gulf. It's almost impossible for us to imagine our way back to what it was like in 1914 in the months leading up to the Great War. Can you help us do that? What was it like? And are there echoes today that you see? You've written about some in thinking about the conflict in Europe and some of the conflicts in the Middle East.
I don't think a lot of people were thinking that a war was coming, even in early 1914. I mean, they'd got used to the fact that there'd been crises before, but everyone had somehow muddled through them. And I think we should never underestimate just the sheer role of accident. I don't think that war in 1914 had to happen. It hadn't happened in previous years, even though there'd been talk of war. And I think what you got at the very end, in the last month of the crisis, before Europe went to war in a general war at the beginning of August 1914, was a series of very human mistakes, miscalculations, failures to understand what the other side might do. I think they could have avoided the accident. I don't think it had to happen. And I think we have to hope today that we will have leaders who are wise enough, who are sensible enough not to move precipitously, who are prepared to try and understand the other side, prepared always to talk to the other side. So I think we shouldn't be too pessimistic. I think we have a lot of goodwill in the world, a lot of sense that people want peace to continue. But I think we should really be careful, because I think we should recognize that accidents do happen, and I think we really have to be careful to try and avert those.
How would you evaluate the rhetoric of President Obama? He's certainly a great speaker and can evoke a mood. But does he sound to you like someone who is complacent, or does he sound more to you like a Churchill who's absolutely convinced that he knows what's about to happen?
I think he sounds to me more like some of those Democratic leaders, including Neville Chamberlain in the years before the Second World War, who were very concerned. I mean, I think Chamberlain's been unfairly attacked as an appeaser, who were very concerned about the rise of Hitler and the aggressive policies of countries such as Germany, Japan, or Italy, but who were trying to build a coalition to deal with it. And it's always a problem for democracies, because we have to get consensus and we have to work together. It seems to me Obama is trying, I think quite rightly, to bring different countries in the West together to act in a unified way. But it's not easy, because until there's a very clear and pressing threat, we tend to always think of our own national interests. And what Obama is doing, I think quite rightly, is signaling that there really is a concern about the way in which Russia is behaving, but is trying to keep the door open to more negotiations and trying, I hope, to show the Russians that, you know, they really have to be careful not to go too far. I mean, a lot of it depends now on what Putin does.
And where does Putin sit in thinking back to 1914? Does he remind you of a character who was a change agent then, or is he something fundamentally different?
I think he is a character as a change agent. I can't think of an exact analogy in 1914. He's a passionate nationalist. I mean, he's someone who's been deeply humiliated, like many Russians have been, about what happened to the Soviet Union after the beginning of the 1990s, the way it fell to pieces, the way Russia was left as a much smaller country with huge economic problems, with much diminished influence internationally. And I think he's thinking perhaps a sort of parallel, but then they're not the same sorts of characters, is with Kaiser Wilhelm II of Germany before 1914, who also felt very strongly that Germany was not getting its place in the sun, was not getting the recognition internationally that it should. And I think this is something that moves Putin. I mean, you saw it in his speech last week. You know, we've had enough of being pushed around. We've had enough of being told what to do. And I think this is something we all have to understand in the West. This is a very deeply motivated man who wants to restore what he sees as Russian grandeur and greatness.
And if we think about the world back then, it was a smaller place. The flashpoint, of course, was Sarajevo and the Balkans. But there are numerous potential flashpoints, and you've written about them here. And we're not simply talking about Crimea. You could also speak of Iran. You could speak of Damascus. You could speak of Moldova. You could speak of Chechnya if you wanted to. How many more flashpoints do you think there are today than there were in 1914?
Well, I think there were quite a few in 1914 as well, because there'd been quite a lot of colonial rivalry. For example, the British and the French nearly came to war in 1898 over a bit of the Sudan. And so I think flashpoints are always there. It's what you make of them. And in a very globalized world, of course, powers have international interests and are more likely to get into flashpoints much further away from home. I think another potentially very dangerous area for us in the present time is the seas, are the seas between China and Japan, where you have a number of national interests, a number of claims being made. And I think what's very dangerous is when you get nations talking of things like prestige and honor. These are intangible things, but they're things that nations often feel very deeply. And of course, again, what is similar, I think, today to the past is the way in which public opinion is playing a role.
And there, of course, is the pivot to Asia that the president really wanted to be the feature of his foreign policy. Maybe that's the blinder in this 2014 analogy to 1914, that, in fact, we're not really thinking of Asia. We're thinking much more of what's going on in Europe. And that could be the outlier, the surprise 100 years later.
Well, we don't hear so much about the pivot to Asia now, do we? I mean, I think that was very much the theme of the first term of President Obama's presidency. But clearly, the United States still has massive Asian interests. But I think it was always a mistake on the part, perhaps, of the president to ignore Europe quite so much. It's still enormously important for the United States in terms of alliances, in terms of commonality of interests, and also, of course, in terms of trade and security. And I think a mistake that a lot of people made, and I suppose that we can't always worry about everything at once, but I think we did collectively, and I would say this goes for administrations as well as for members of the public like me, we tended to assume that Russia would just be content to chug along as it was, sort of on the edge of Europe, not really all that important. And I think that was a mistake. I think we failed to recognize the depth of the sense of humiliation in Russia. And it may be too late to do much about it now. I mean, I think what is important now is to have a strong and robust response to what is going on in Russia and to make it clear to Putin that if he tries to move into eastern Ukraine, that Russia will suffer consequences, economic consequences, for example.
Margaret McMillan is the author of The War That Ended Peace, The Road to 1914. She's professor of international history at Oxford University. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Let's leave you now for the moment with this moment from President Obama today speaking at the Flanders Field, quoting the famous poem known by virtually every schoolboy and schoolgirl of the 20th century in Europe, In Flanders Field, by Colonel John McRae, who died in 1918.
To you, from failing hands we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders fields. What is lesser known is that 3 years after he wrote those words, and thousands of miles away, an American schoolteacher named Moina Michael read McRae's poem, and she was so moved that she wrote a response. Oh, you who sleep in Flanders fields, sleep sweet to rise anew. We caught the torch you threw, and holding high, we keep the faith with all who died.
And the band played Waltzing Matilda as the ship pulled away from the quay, and amid all the tears, flag waving and cheers, we sailed off for Gallipoli.
Another deadline, another extension to sign up for the Affordable Care Act. Hey, folks, you don't have to worry about March 31st anymore. You've been extended. As of March 17th, though, over 5 million Americans had signed up for the Affordable Care Act. The Obama administration is projecting that at least 6 million will be registered by Monday, and I suppose more after that. Eric Sturgis, what's it going to take to close the deal with you?
Well, you're going to have to make the system allow me to log in so that I can actually purchase and pick a policy that works for me.
Eric is a 47-year-old business owner from Tacoma, Washington. How many times have you tried to sign up, Eric?
I've tried multiple times, dozens.
All right, Eric, hold on there. Chad Lindsay, what's it going to take to close the deal with you?
I guess real affordable care, meaning a cheaper deductible.
Cheaper deductible. Now, Chad Lindsay is a 31-year-old from Arlington, Texas. You basically don't see an incentive to sign up, whether the website works or not, right?
Right, that's right. Yeah, if the deductible is higher than I can pay, I mean, and insurance doesn't kick in until after you pay the $6,000 deductible that you can't afford, I just don't see the point.
All right, to both of you, the Obama administration would love to get both of you signed up. And Eric, it looks like there might be more of a prospect with you than there is for Chad here. What would insurance mean for you if you actually could get signed up? I could snap my fingers and make it happen. At the end of the day, what's your expectation about how your life will change with affordable care?
Well, I've been paying for my own insurance for years, my own doctor visits, and I go frequently. So it will save me probably thousands of dollars every year if I can get signed up.
Have you tried finding a navigator, some of these people who can help you get over the kind of online pitfalls, maybe talk to a social worker, something like that?
Oh, yes. After they determined that my account was permanently locked, that their IT department can't unlock it at this time, they sent me to one of the people to help me navigate at a community center. And the agent there, she could not get into my account either. She couldn't see what the problem was. She could see that I had an account and that I had some choices available, but she wasn't able to tell me what they were because everything was grayed out on her screen.
So that's Eric Sturgis's story. Chad, Lindsay, I gather listening to Eric, we're just adding up the disincentives for you to even try here, right?
No, I would actually like to have insurance. I just like it to be affordable.
What are you paying now for health care? And do you even go to the doctor? You're 31 years old. I suspect you're a pretty healthy fellow.
So that's right. Yeah, I'm 31 years old. I've actually never had health insurance. I guess they say that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So I exercise regularly. I eat healthy. I try to minimize stress in my life. I don't get sick that often, but when I do, it's not a big deal for me to pay out of pocket.
But couldn't you just go to an insurance company and get a great policy because of your, are you a smoker?
No, I'm not a smoker. No. So health insurance through my job is unaffordable. So I was able to look at plans on the healthcare.gov on the marketplace. And the cheapest one I could afford is $59 per month, which isn't bad, but it's just that deductible is $6,000.
$6,000. Is there any way to lower the deductible and raise your premium?
There is, right, yes. But currently, right now, where I'm at, about $60 a month is all I could afford.
Now, that's less than a cell phone.
Yeah, it is, but I'm a single father.
Ah, is your child covered?
He is, yeah. He's covered through CHIPS. It's, health insurance for children.
So that's interesting. The fact that CHIPS exists for your son, it really means that you don't have the incentive to sign up for a program that would rope both of you in. If your son was just as much out in the cold as you, you would be much more enthusiastic about that deductible.
Yes, that's true.
Interesting. All right. So, Eric Sturgis, what's the next step for you?
I'm not sure. They've set up an emergency system here in Washington, where I live, that allows you to get health coverage. The state will set up a special policy and a special plan and get you covered right away. But when you try to call that number, you spend about 5 minutes going through the prompts and you get told at the end, "We're sorry, all circuits are busy. Please call again later." So I'm kind of stuck in limbo.
But you do have a little more time with the deadline being extended.
Well, that's great, but I'm still stuck paying for my medications and doctor's visit. It's not that I'm in bad or poor health, but I take blood pressure medicine and I have back issues and knee issues because I'm getting a little older and these things are getting expensive.
And appearances by the president on comedy shows online isn't necessarily going to make you feel any better.
No, not unless he's willing to write a check to reimburse me or pay for it himself. It doesn't matter what he does.
All right. Well, good luck to you, Eric Sturgis, a business owner in Tacoma, Washington. And best of luck to Chad Lindsay, 31-year-old medical records specialist in Arlington, Texas. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up later this hour, we'll have a conversation about technology that wants to turn all of healthcare into a networked digital system. That would mean healthcare.gov would be your doctor. Scary. Which may raise the question, do you control your technology in your life, or does tech control you?
This is Sherry from Austin, My cell phone controls me. This is mainly due to the fact that my husband travels every week on business and we have elderly parents. It helps me to rest easier because I know that I can be reached. Sometimes I think back to how life was before we had information at our fingertips, and I remember that life was a lot quieter.
Well, Sherry sounds a little enslaved, but she certainly has her act together. From Eugene, Oregon, one of you writes, actually, right at this moment, I was playing acoustic guitar and wanted to stop to answer this question, so I guess I do let it control me in a way. I do try to spend at least an hour a day completely disconnected, no phone, iPod, or tablet computer. I return to nature, and it re-energizes me. Or I guess nature orders you around, right? From Brentwood, New York, I design software to do what I want. Often I see people doing what the computer wants instead of what they want or need. And one of you in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, I think technology is a double-edged sword. Technology has the ability to amplify whatever character assets or defects we may have as individuals. So good people make good choices. Not so good people make not so good choices with technology. Are you using technology or is technology using you? We'd love to hear your story. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Follow us on Twitter, at The Takeaway, all one word, at The Takeaway. This is The Takeaway and we control you. Stay with us.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals monitor and manage online reviews. Now offering a review kiosk to help customers create reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com.
Unstable ground and the search for survivors continuing in the mudslide-devastated community of Oso in Snohomish County, Washington State, where the ground gave away over the weekend. Joining us is Ed Ronco. Ed Ronco is Morning Edition reporter and producer for KPLU Public Radio in Seattle. Ed, welcome to the show.
Hi, John.
What's the weather like, and how is that complicating rescue efforts and the search?
We had rain yesterday up there, and it's in the forecast, at least through the weekend. It has turned the mud into a slippery mess. There have been comparisons to quicksand. We've heard reports of rescue workers in the initial stages of the response and yesterday getting mired as they went in, up to their armpits in some cases.
And in the midst of all that, I want to share with our listeners some of the audio that was collected by your news team. Here's Lorey DeColetis, who's still looking for her husband.
We're hoping he's, like, pinned in a closet somewhere in the mud, but they have air pockets, and they're doing okay, and they're keeping each other going.
Are there a lot of stories like that, Ed?
So many stories like that. People hoping beyond hope, even the emergency responders themselves who are starting to finally use the word recovery rather than rescue, are still saying that they're hoping for a miracle, that somebody's in an air pocket somewhere, or that they're going to be able to still find people alive in the mud.
And here's one of the responders, a Red Cross volunteer by the name of Chad Beekler.
And people are just asking, do you know where my family is? And waiting for information about where their mom or dad or son or daughter is at this time. And they just don't know. And it's hard to see that.
You know, we've come through 2 weeks of this dramatic search in the South Indian Ocean. But the search there in Washington State is, you can walk it. They know where these people are. When will people get actual information, do you think?
That's hard to say. They're going to come out with a list a little later today that should provide some of that information. The list of who's missing has run the gamut in specificity from I think Frank was over there, I know he has a cabin in that area, to I'm positive that somebody I know is in there. So it's hard to know exactly who is missing at this point. They've been winnowing down the list from more than 150 reports to try and figure out exactly which are repeat reports, and that number was thrown off a little bit again yesterday by another town in the area regaining communications and finally being able to report in.
And for so many of the residents, the scale of what has happened is really just sinking in. Here's local resident Dougie Dix.
The looks on the faces when the guys came back was somewhere between shock and terror. The first responders, they came up and they came back to tell us to leave. You could tell on their faces something really bad happened.
And I want to play here in conclusion Snohomish County Emergency Management Director John Pennington, who really is trying to make the case that this was an unpredictable disaster.
We've done everything we could to protect them. We've mitigated the landslide from 2006. There's been warnings and advance notifications of their high risk for landslides. We've done everything we could. My heart goes out to all of these individuals. We're going to get to the bottom of this.
Ed Ronco, how much of a danger is this going forward, and what are the lessons for other residents in the mountains?
Rescue efforts earlier were hampered by fear that the landslide could move again. There have been warnings in reports that that landslides could happen there. The Seattle Times in particular reporting on a couple of large reports from the federal government and a county report that highlighted this area in particular as dangerous. Everybody in Western Washington knows that we live in landslide-prone areas, but it's just you can't imagine the magnitude of what's happened out there, and to predict it, there are a lot of questions about that still. Mm.
Ed Ronco, part of the news team covering the devastation in Snohomish County, Washington State. He's Morning Edition reporter and producer for KPLU Public Radio in Seattle. Ed, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
The NCAA tournament proceeds on television, and our TV Greats competition, a bracket to end all brackets, continues right here and at thetakeaway.org. Another elimination round. Yesterday, Mary Richards of The Mary Tyler Moore Show stomped in a very unmodest Mary way, duplicitous Olivia Pope of Scandal. I mean, who was going to make it after all in that one, right?
Although I must say, it certainly is accurate.
You voted, and you can see the specific vote counts at thetakeaway.org, as well as all the other elimination results on the way to crowning a champion best TV character of all time. And so, the games continue. Entering the arena, two more members of our staff, each with a TV great, one arguing for Archie Bunker of All in the Family, and one for Columbo, the detective in the trench coat.
It's probably been a while since you've seen an episode of All in the Family, so maybe you're wondering, what was so great about Archie Bunker? After all, he was a racist.
There's one thing Archie Bunker ain't never gonna do, and that's break bread with no jungle bunnies.
He was a homophobe.
Archie, this is a bag to carry things in. What's wrong with that?
If you don't know, buddy, I'll spell it out, you F-A-G fruit.
He was an anti-Semitic, male chauvinist, communist-baiting, anti-intellectual.
Not all Jewish people are rich.
I never knew one that wasn't.
God made man his own image. He made women after, from a rib. A cheaper cut.
Medical science is a lot of crapola.
But you know what? Deep down, Archie Bunker really did believe in one America, with liberty and justice for all, even if he wasn't always happy about it.
I'm as true blue as you or you. Hey, I'm against all the right things.
That's why Archie Bunker is the greatest television character of all time. Anyone who says different is a communist.
Meantime, you can mail your opinions back to the Kremlin, huh?
Vote for Archie Bunker at thetakeaway.org.
Those were the days.
Just one more thing.
Really? I have more than one thing to say about why Columbo is the greatest TV character of all time. But actually, Columbo says it better.
I'm going to have to make this fast, sir. We know the chimp was in the studio on the night of the murder. Now we know you were there.
So, I have to thank my wife for one. Because she's mad at everybody. She's even mad at the ice cream man.
You know, when my wife and I try to remember what happened yesterday or the day before, well, we don't agree on anything. And you two, you not only agree, you use almost the exact same words to tell about it. Now, that is a lie.
Where were you, sir, on the night that Freddy died?
Oh, there's one little thing.
Gee, I almost forgot.
There's one other thing I wanted to talk to you about.
Columbo ran from both 1968 to 1978, and then again from 1989 to 2003. That's 5 decades of Columbo. And how many TV characters can say that?
Maybe I've been at this job too long.
Case closed, my friends. Vote for Columbo at thetakeaway.org.
A That's Movie Date co-host Rafer Guzman taking on associate producer Ali Ferguson in a battle of Archie Bunker versus Columbo. Cast your ballot in today's Takeaway TV Brackets battle at thetakeaway.org and feel free to mention which characters you think were left out of our TV Brackets contest while you're there, or just call us at 8778-MY-TAKE. Here's a recap. For the men, Data of Star Trek Next Generation beat Don Draper of Mad Men. Tony Soprano of The Sopranos destroyed Saul Goodman of Breaking Bad. That means next week, the Elite Eight will pit Soprano and Data against each other. And for the women, Liz Lemon of 30 Rock slam dunk Daenerys Targaryen of Game of Thrones, which means Liz Lemon will face off against Mary Richards in the Elite Eight. But of course, we still need to finish up this week's Sweet 16. As a reminder, cast your votes at thetakeaway.org.
Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals monitor and manage online reviews, now offering a review kiosk to help customers create reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com.
So you nerdy folks out there probably know this. My daughters do. One of the pioneers in computer programming was Ada Lovelace, the 19th century woman, romantic and intellectual, who collaborated with mechanical computer inventor Charles Babbage back in the 1840s. Lovelace was the software wizard to Babbage's hardware genius. Her calculating programs paved the way for modern algorithms that can be found today in your electronic calculator. Ada Lovelace had math and software in her blood, apparently. Daughter of Lord Byron, the poet. There's some software. But Lovelace was a loner in her time. Unlike Maria Clave, a computer scientist, she calls it CS, of today, and president of Harvey Mudd College in Claremont, California.
I'm of an age that when I went to college, there were very few women majoring in mathematics. There were actually many more women at that time majoring in computer science than there were in mathematics, which is pretty funny. It used to be that when people were thinking about majoring in computer science, nobody had any experience with computers in the home because there weren't any PCs at that point. And so people weren't really sure what it was all about, but it seemed to involve typing. And for some reason, that seemed to be something that women were thought to be possibly good at.
Well, today, the presumption that women would excel at computer science, and especially coding and programming, has slipped in favor of men who are overwhelmingly represented in the ranks of coders graduating from college. Who is trying to change that? Let's talk to New Tech City host Manoush Zomorodi. Welcome, Manoush.
Hello there, John.
So what have we lost here in America, and why?
There was this key moment, it turns out, in the middle of the 80s when PCs came into homes and schools. And what happened was is that most of the kids, what they did with PCs was they played computer games. And most of those computer games were sort of shoot 'em up sort of things and sort of boy-centric stuff. And very quickly, this is according to Maria Clave, and I remember this myself growing up in the 80s, boys became the computer hogs at homes and schools, and it sort of just seemed that computers were a boy thing. And the percentage of computer science majors, which had been pretty much equal, dropped precipitously, almost like, you know, dying out like the dinosaurs, down to 10%.
Blame it all on Gonzaga and asteroids. Well, why did this happen in America? Because it's really an American thing here.
Yes, very much so. The U.S. is behind tons of other countries when it comes to offering computer science to school-age kids. Now, I spoke to some female computer science majors at Hunter here in New York City. They were from Russia, from India, and neither of them could think of any other classmates who were born or raised in the U.S. who were also female. Akanksha Verma is from India.
The fact that they don't offer computer science here at high school level, I thought that was really disappointing because when I was in India, I did my 9th and 10th grade there, and I had a very strong computer science background from India. But when I came here, when I did the rest of my high school, there was no computer science. Like, I completely lost touch with computer science pretty much as a high school student in America.
So the divide in the United States between, imported students and homegrown American students. How are institutions trying to correct this?
So at Harvey Mudd, they took a very specific approach. They renamed the introduction course from Introduction to Programming in Java to something called Creative Approaches to Problem Solving in Science and Engineering Using Python. Using words like creative and problem solving, that just sounded more approachable. They taught Python, which is more forgiving and practical. And what they did was they divided the class into two groups, gold for people with no coding experience and black for those with some coding experience. Instead of trying to weed out the weak, they also implemented something that they called eliminating the macho effect. You know that guy in the front of the class who's always raising his hand and he knows what everything. Well,
you're,
they took
you're
him aside.
To him.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Well, John, Sorry. They would have taken you aside and they would have said, you're so
yeah.
passionate about the material. You're so well prepared.
Yeah.
Let's continue our conversations just one-on-one, you and me, and let's not intimidate the other people who don't go there. Now, this class was just as challenging, just as tough, and the women stuck with it. And literally overnight, Harvey Mudd's introductory computer science went from being the most despised introductory course to the absolute favorite.
And in terms of its track record in attracting women, what's the rate?
Well, it went up to 40%. They now have 40% computer science
wow.
majors. And this has
That's
been
huge.
Applied in numerous other variations on the theme at places like Duke, at Berkeley.
What's going on at Hunter?
Well, yeah, so back to Hunter, they have not applied any of these, and they really are lamenting their sort of gender difference, because here's what the head of the computer science department says is the problem that typically happens with the curriculum.
The first program that almost everybody writes is called the Hello World program, where you get the computer to print out the message Hello World in a programmatic way. Almost universally, it's, wow, that's cool. I mean, everybody gets that. I think the difference is that the male students look around and say, well, how exactly did that happen? Whereas the women students probably look at it and say, oh, wow, that's cool. What else can I do?
The diplomatic William Sackis, who heads the computer science department at Hunter, does he have a preference over female to male students?
No, but what he's saying right now is that the college curriculum at most places really plays to the male students' typical inclination. And one thing that Professor Clave did at Harvey Mudd was focus on projects that really showed the applications of coding, which the women gravitated towards.
We had students working on things like educational games and a version of Dance Dance Revolution for the elderly and epidemiology modeling and, you know, things that they could see you were using computing technology to actually work on something that mattered.
Which are techniques that would be good for anyone to witness in the classroom.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And now that computer science is not a niche thing, as it is infiltrating every single part of our economy, we need more computer-skilled people, period, no matter what their gender.
Manoush Zomorodi. For more of Manoush Zomorodi's reporting on women in coding, just head over to newtechcity.org and be sure to listen to the New Tech City podcast. Thanks, Manoush.
Thank you, John.
So the conversation you are having is about the question, are you in control of how you are using technology?
Hi, my name is Lynn. I'm calling from Watertown, Mass. My phone, my computer, they all own me. I am definitely addicted to my phone. I limit myself to just my smartphone because I feel that if I'm on the computer or I do Facebook or anything like that, I will be sucked in for good.
Lynn is pretty strong out there. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to share your story. React and share at thetakeaway.org. Coming up, how technological systems want to make all jobs industrial processes. We'll explain what that means in a moment.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com.
You hold that glittering technology in your hands, you touch the screen of your iPad, and you can just about believe that you are the master.
This is the Cinderella of the IT world. Everybody knows about Steve Jobs and iPhones and iPads, but there is this whole unknown world of what I call and what are known as computer business systems, and these are control systems for businesses, large corporations, but small businesses can use them too.
Oxford and NYU scholar Simon Head says don't be fooled by techie gadgets. There is as much investment into vast networked computer control and monitoring systems in the workplace as there is in flashy new consumer devices. Head tells this disturbing technology story in his book, Mindless: Why Smarter Machines Are Making Dumber Humans, or humans who simply feel dumber, like this former employee at Amazon in this BBC documentary who resigned after spending days hooked up to a monitoring scanner that watched his every move.
Like a lot of people, I'm used to Amazon as a customer, and it's convenient and bright. So I sort of thought if I was going to go and work for the company, it would sort of be a happy, positive place, but it seems to be the complete opposite, to be quite honest.
Big companies including Amazon, Target, Verizon, and Walmart use monitoring systems to measure performance down to the second, storing it in giant databases. They use the data to gain greater and greater control over workers. Simon Head says millions of workers already feel the weight of these networked eyes and ears on the workplace.
Well, they bear profoundly on your life. They bear on every single second that you're in the Amazon fulfillment center, because you have work to do. You have to take packages from the packaging station to the shelf. And if you're an Amazon employee, you're tagged with a computer which tells you what route to take in these gigantic warehouses. And it tells you how much time you have to do it. And if you're behind schedule a little bit, it starts to bleep in an absolutely infernal way. I mean, the BBC did a documentary. It got somebody into an Amazon fulfillment center with a tag on it. It showed them being beeped, and it showed the supervisor saying, you were several seconds over your schedule, and if you go on like that, you'll get a demerit, and if you accumulate enough demerits, you're out. And this is really a world that descends from the assembly line of the Ford era. There is no difference.
And these beeps are all connected to vast computer networks that are recording data on people's performance, on their absences, on what they're doing, related to video data. It's virtually limitless, the amount of data that these systems can take on all kinds of employees.
Absolutely. It's absolutely limitless. But the key feature of these systems is that they can apply to practically anything. They can apply to physicians, areas like so-called customer relations management, human resource management, financial services they apply, and they share these characteristics of subjecting employees to rigorous regimes of targeting and timing.
How do they make humans dumber? And use examples from the financial industry, as you do in your book, as well as places like Walmart.
I think they make them dumber in two ways. The first and less obvious way is to impose these rigorous regimes of timing. You have to accomplish the task in a certain period of time. The effect of this to something like call centers, for example, there's a difference between, in the call center, allowing the employee to figure out a solution to a problem which the customer has, whether it's a problem with the product, and having a so-called expert system do it, so that the function of the employee is to feed the case history into the expert system, and the expert system gives the answer.
Therefore, employees have little discretion. They're basically following instructions that are right in front of their faces, and it makes it easy for the entire enterprise to be like a collective group of lemmings going over the cliff, which was what you describe at Goldman Sachs, where expensive and sophisticated technology was used to create a financial system that just went off the cliff.
Right. But these systems are very dysfunctional, because when they deal with transactions between humans, even if it's a call center, there is great complexity in understanding what people are saying. They often don't speak in a clear way, and in understanding the psychological undercurrents underlying what they say. But if you look at Goldman Sachs and the whole fantastic mortgage machine, which ran amok in the run-up to the financial crisis, then you have these systems being misapplied in the case of estimating, for example, the creditworthiness of people applying for really expensive mortgages. Instead of looking carefully at whether they ought to have a mortgage, you use a so-called expert system to do it for you. And you can game the expert system to give a mortgage to practically everybody, anybody. And that's what they did, with disastrous consequences, not only for the U.S. economy, but for the entire global economy.
What is the balanced scorecard that seems to be the current huge fad in these kinds of systems being applied in the workplace?
The balanced scorecard is to use information systems to specify targets for all levels of the enterprise. So actually, there's a real parallel with the way the old planning system worked in the Soviet Union. What you can do with information systems is to change the targets in the light of changed economic circumstances. And then, having set the targets, you have monitoring systems to estimate in real time whether people are meeting the targets.
So instead of Stalin's five-year plan, you've got the balanced scorecard's five-nanosecond plan.
That's right. And what's so ironic is that there's this tremendous fuss, quite rightly, about the NSA scandal and the monitoring that Snowden uncovered. But there is this gigantic apparatus of monitoring and surveillance in the corporate world already.
And who is the workforce target here?
Almost the whole workforce.
Finally, if you're a CEO in this environment, can you run a gigantic corporation from a spreadsheet on your desk, even a video game on your desk? Or does this take power away from the very top of corporate management?
I think it centralizes power, and I think that's one of the enormous attractions of it. It concentrates great power. It's easy for them to exercise control to an office in Japan as it is to the office next door. It eliminates distance.
So the verdict here, at least as far as your research is concerned, is that this proliferation of these kinds of systems would tend to work against innovation, not necessarily encourage it.
Well, I think it's paradoxical. When I first did research on these systems way back in the late 90s, these software startups in Silicon Valley, they had all the sort of characteristics of a dynamic, hip, fluid California startup. But sometimes, if you ask the CEO, what do these systems do? I remember one of them saying to me, these systems are great for managers. The managers can know and do everything. So you have the paradox of the innovativeness and hipness of the companies, and certainly the non-hipness of what they're actually doing to the businesses which take on their systems.
Simon Head is the author of Mindless: Why Smarter Machines Are Making Dumber Humans. Thanks so much.
Pleasure.
Some stories from you on control and technology. Rochester, New York, I can still sew, chop wood for fuel. I think I can live without Facebook. Be nice to actually write a letter again. I don't think it controls me or it. However, it does make things in certain respects easier. Or Honolulu, Hawaii. It controls me. It makes so much information available immediately that my memory is diminished. However, it spreads that knowledge and allows for working more efficiently. Overall, I don't like smartphone dependency. Me either. Share your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Join the conversation at thetakeaway.org, where you can also vote for the greatest TV character of all time. Look for the SmackDown. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.